This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of Urban Political Podcast. And today we are discussing a new book called Infrastructural Times, Temporality and the Making of Global Urban Worlds, which is a recent edited volume by Jean-Paul Adi, Michael Glass, and Jean Nellis. And today, to discuss the book with us, we have one of the editors of the book, Jean-Paul Adi, and we have three wonderful guests, Hannah Baumann, Himanshu Burte, and Fenna Herfslut. I would not say much about them, but they'll introduce themselves in just a bit and say a little bit about the intersection of their work with the book as well. So, Hannah, please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm an interdisciplinary urban scholar. I'm based at UCL, and the focus of my work is on the role of infrastructure in mediating urban participation and exclusion. In addition to infrastructure as a kind of empirical object of research, I'm interested in it as a methodological approach. So applying infrastructural ways of thinking to efforts to conceptualize and operationalize concepts like prosperity or vulnerability. I find this quite useful because it allows us to focus on resources held in common and questions of distributive and redistributive justice. Something I work with and we work with in my department a lot is this notion of universal basic services, for example. More recently, I've been engaged in co-design processes with communities that are excluded from infrastructural provision in order to kind of jointly reimagine future public services that enable more access to the city's resources for everyone. Thanks so much for inviting me and for the opportunity to engage with the book. As I'm going first, maybe I thought I'd introduce the book in a bit more detail than you have, Nin. So the aim of the book is to advance our understanding of how time infrastructure relations are entwined in the production, governance, and lived experience of global urban worlds. And in terms of its structure, it has three main sections. The first one focuses on the way infrastructures link and reconfigure relations between past, present, and future. The second one focuses on infrastructure-led development and how conflicting temporalities can arise from it. And the third one disrupts notions of time as self-evidently linear or universal by showing how time can be disrupted, suspended, accelerated, and so on. The book has an introduction and a conclusion by the three editors, kind of methodological chapter by Adi, and 10 contributors chapters that range very widely in terms of the spatial scale they focus on, sort of from the neighborhood to across boundary region, in terms of the temporal scope. So we have some references to, Roman roads, and we're also talking about, self-healing infrastructural systems of the near future. And also geographic focus, really moving from West Papua to San Francisco, all across the globe, including global north and global south localities. The book makes a really significant contribution to infrastructure studies by highlighting the ways in which infrastructure is not just spatial, but deeply temporal. It shows how infrastructures operate across different timelines and shape temporalities, influencing urban development, governance, and life in profound ways. And I want to highlight three ways in which I believe this will be a really useful resource to scholars of infrastructure. The first one is expanding the definition of infrastructure time. The book advocates for this notion of infrastructure time as a multidimensional concept. This goes beyond viewing time as linear to include cyclical, asynchronous, and discontinuous temporalities. Secondly, it offers a range of methodological frameworks and conceptual tools for infrastructure studies. So for example, Adi's chapter, inspired by Lefebvre, proposes rhythm analysis as a method for studying infrastructure to assess how infrastructures impose rhythms on urban life through routine cycles and disruptions. What was really valuable to me as well was the emphasis on power relations and hierarchies of domination at work in infrastructural time across the different chapters. So the introduction includes a debate on the idea of infrastructure as a temporal fix that absorbs capital and locks regions into particular developmental trajectories. The second section focuses on development in terms of infrastructure temporalities, and that already challenges the idea of infrastructure as a linear developmental path and invites debate on the impact of asynchronous developments, as well as the affective and material impacts of disruptions that large infrastructural projects often bring when they result in suspended lives and livelihoods for those people who are at the receiving end of them. So collectively, this wide-ranging set of contributions brings a really critical temporal dimension to infrastructure studies. In the spirit of kind of expanding this important conversation that we've all been part of in different ways, I had a few areas where I think we could talk about sort of additional engagement. And I want to start with one that that intersects with my work in particular. So the editors state that the book has the ambition to open up possibilities to create more equitable infrastructure futures. And several of the chapters also allude to this. And this is an interest of mine, as I said. So I would have been keen to have seen more about this, given that section one was more or less about the past, section two more or less about development in the present, but then three wasn't about the future, but it was about disruptions. Strong emphasis on kind of the role of power relations in infrastructural time, to me, opened up that question of just infrastructural futures. Coutard in his chapter suggests different alternative approaches to exploring urban futures and future infrastructures, and he proposes this idea of speculative design in there. And I thought that would be really interesting to include in this debate as well. There was sort of one in the final chapter, which I thought was a real standout chapter by Amelia Thorpe. There was a kind of successful instance of a propositional work where a group in San Francisco called the San Francisco Municipal Transformation Agency was doing a kind of guerrilla prototyping of cycling safety infrastructure. And Thorpe talks about this as DIY infrastructure as prefiguration, which I found really compelling, because these prototypes that are done by these community groups are then actually taken up by the city and sort of formalized. And I found that really evocative for imagining kind of future directions of infrastructural engagements, but also research. So I understand, of course, that this book is grounded in what's been called critical infrastructure studies, and it already covers a lot of ground. But I would have welcomed papers that maybe have a more hands-on involvement in how we develop more just design and planning processes that result in infrastructures that serve the collective goods. And these could draw on fields like infrastructure humanities or design justice, perhaps. Here I was also thinking about the kind of multiple ways of knowing that are highlighted throughout, and I think in the introduction and conclusion. And something that stood out to me in the chapters here was Biglieri and Kyle's reference to CRIP near futures. They talk about working with people that are most excluded by the existing infrastructure arrangements to think about how infrastructural futures can be reconfigured. So I think for conversations going forward, it might be worth exploring the role and responsibility of researchers in working towards these more just infrastructural futures, including learning from people and communities with lived experience of infrastructural exclusion and developing methodologies for knowledge exchange, linking them into political and development processes that can be influenced by the academy, perhaps.
Well, that was very interesting to hear, Anna, and that was really an excellent overview of the book. I'm Himanshu Gurte. I'm an architect by background, and I teach at the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay, in Mumbai. I'm currently I'm associate professor at the Yashankar Desai Center for Policy Studies at IIT Bombay. And thank you very much, Nitin, for organizing this and inviting me to be part of this, which also I think a great privilege of this invitation that's come with the invitation has been the opportunity to read this wonderful book. And I think we have already heard a very good overview of what the book sets out to do. So what I'll do is I'll reflect a bit on some of the themes or the kinds of things that it achieves and the themes that I find very useful to take ahead in my own work. But before that, a little bit about where I'm coming from to this conversation. So my work is one of my key areas of interest has really been the way transport infrastructure in India, and starting from Mumbai where I'm based, has been conceived of on the one hand, and the kind of lived experiences it has produced in both through the physical intervention and reshaping of the city on the one hand, but also increasingly in my new work, the experiences of certain kinds of neglected mobility. So I'm working on a project right now on the walking practices of women domestic workers. And incidentally, it's a collaboration with colleagues in Lima who are doing work there on the same practices. So on the one hand, that, and the other dimension of my work, which again brings me here, is an interest in the way policy and planning understand space, but also time, specifically time. In a sense, one of the questions has been what kind of time does policy inhabit or work from, in a sense. So I really found this book very, very exciting because while there has been very interesting work and a long history of thinking about time in the urban domain or even about larger social science domain, I think thinking about infrastructure time is very timely, as we know, and especially speaking from a place like India, where we are seeing a veritable explosion. You know, we are in a kind of infrastructure age, whether we like it or not, and whether it makes sense or not. But you know, I drew some solace from examples in the book. Egypt is a great example of many parallels there of infrastructure being taken up without necessarily being in a position to fulfill all its promises. So let me jump into first reflecting on what the book really presents and what it has done at multiple levels. I must say it's really a very, very exciting book to read because of many things, the range of things that Anna spoke about, but also because of a very successful effort at bringing onto the same platform very, very serious and creative theorizing with very intricate, grounded, but theoretically productive empirical work. And reading all of them between the same covers is really absolutely very, very rewarding. The book, for instance, has all manner of conceptual resources and discussions, whether it's to do with the past, present, and future relations, the way they're constructed, small things like lock-ins into certain trajectories, to broader ideas like plural temporalities, which in a sense I thought took time back into space. You know, if by space we understand as a kind of simultaneity of many different trajectories, as Massey made very clear many years ago. Also, deliciously subversive ideas like counterfactual history as an antidote to the tyranny of the past, of presentism and futurism, or the dialectic of waiting or suspension and speed. So I think these frameworks, not all of which are only from the so-called theoretical chapters here, underscoring the fact that the theory and the more empirical work really work very well together and speak to each other. In a sense, it also sketches at a kind of meta-text level a kind of virtual prehistory of infrastructure studies through its various citations and quotations. And that is, I think, a very, very valuable resource for contemporary infrastructure studies. Now, the book also, for me, raised to view and for close attention some themes that I had not very consciously been engaging with very directly, but which are of great relevance to thinking about the infrastructural imaginary. The first, of course, is the relationship between presentism and futurism. And this comes out well both in Kuta's work, paper here, when you read it along with Timothy Moss's paper, which looks at the history and the resource of usable paths of ideas and experiments in the stream, which are usable for present making as well as future making of various kinds. This dialectic of futurist and presentist ideology, which almost turns away from the future and maybe even denies the past in many ways, is something that helps us map the turn to mega projects that Schindler and Kunai discuss, which as they make very clear, and which Vardhan and El-Shayal, I think, consolidate further in the chapter on the Cairo monorail, is really has been this turn to mega projects has been steered through the construct of the infrastructural deficit. And in that idea of a deficit of infrastructure, I think already we see a very interesting illustration of that tension between presentism as well as which is connected to futurism of a certain kind. Particularly, I find it interesting, and maybe later we can talk a bit more about it, how this makes sense of a particular direction of thinking about infrastructure that policy in India has taken on, which is simultaneously presentist and futurist, but in many ways, which is closing off potentially certain kinds of possible futures. The other thing that I'll just end with, which I find very, very productive, and which is emphasized later on in the book, toward the end even more, is the tension between the infrastructural and the urban. And this is, in some of the work I've done, I've been struck by how in Mumbai, for instance, increasingly infrastructure is overcoming the history and the density of place and our relationships with place itself. So there is a lot here, I think, across these two themes and more, which we could fruitfully engage and, I think, extend in future work.
I'll continue from there and try to build on the comments of Hannah and Himanshu. I'm Fena. I'm a research fellow at UCL, and my research mainly engages with how digital technologies sort of reproduce and restructure infrastructures and inequalities within urban space. And I really enjoyed reading this book. It's been a real pleasure to be taken along the many sort of different times and temporalities that are constructed through infrastructure across the world, and really delving into sort of the expansive conceptual toolkit that is provided throughout the different chapters. Now, the authors describe anticipating speculation of future making in the Anthropocene to understand time to infrastructural innovation, trying to speed up time, the way we learn from the past, how the present features in sort of the future, and how that's all built into the city and very important to understand the urban. So in doing so, the book provides a very wide lexicon for thinking and writing about infrastructural time, from lived speed and temporal problems to rhythms, sequencing and suspension of time through waiting. And I'm sure that there's many more concepts to be listed that I've not mentioned here right now. Yeah, so reading the book also made me think about time and all its contradictions and demands on society. And I think particularly as the chapters travel from Berlin to West Papua to Ciudad Guiana and the US, the authors delve into the structural and political dimensions of time and also explore our responses to it, or the different types of responses that society has to time imposed through urban infrastructure. So across all the contexts, one of the recurring themes that I took from it is this tension between imposed and lived time, and between the different temporalities dictated by capitalist markets and the enduring histories of urban infrastructure, but also the rhythms and repetitions of daily and political life in the present. And as the editors also write in their conclusions, and we should really understand infrastructural time as a social construct, and that it's very much plural in its presence of multiple temporalities. Yeah, so it's done a great job in sort of deconstructing time for me and temporalities in a very inspiring way that I think gives a lot of tools to continue with. The
diversity in the experiences of time is also illustrated in the range of temporalities addressed in the different papers. So Timothy Moss and Jessica DiCarlo discussed the long durée of time by unpacking how history continues in the structures of today. And Simon Marvin and Jonathan Rutherford, in their chapter, focus on the importance of microseconds in creating seamless transitions between normal and emergency modes in electricity grids, or creating this always-on experience. And one of the things that I really appreciated in reading Infrastructural Times is that it doesn't only teaches us about sort of the repetitions of the past and our inabilities to predict and act upon the future, but that it also really shows how present time is constructed. And specifically in the chapters of Coutard and Simon, they think through infrastructural times to understand what the present is, although they discuss this in different ways and sort of a different presents constructed. Coutard describes the pervasiveness of presentness, and Simon conceptualizes newness as this liminal, never-ending present without clear history or future, but created through the repetition of everyday existence. Also, Ekman in chapter 6 discusses how the future is made present through the construction of infrastructure, and the plans that they contain for the future are materialized in the city of today. So the book is really rich in the narratives and reveals this multiplicity of temporalities within infrastructure. But there are also a couple of questions that lingered with me in reading it. And specifically, I was kind of thinking about if these new temporalities are constantly constructed, do they ever end? And when is infrastructural time past? So this question stayed with me in reading the book, and also thinking about the Roman networks that Hannah also mentioned that still determine many of the paths that we walk in European cities, or the annual floods in cities such as Guadalajara because the rivers have been built onto. We sort of see how infrastructures can be materially deconstructed, but still have a lasting effects on our experiences of cities. So they leave a type of mark or scar in the landscape way beyond their material lifespan. Now, this kind of made me think of, when is infrastructural time really over? And can we reverse or rewind infrastructural time? Or does it become a part of urban memory, like an archive of these spatial temporal snapshots, which resurface once in a while and subconsciously shape the city and how it is, like how we behave within it? So that's one question that I would love to discuss with you guys. And another was a little bit, it was on a different scale, and that was about the home and the temporalities of infrastructure that structure our families and home life and homelessness. And the editors in the final chapter raised the issue of the city at night and kind of touch upon issues of the home and homelessness, and like by understanding the city as the space-time that challenges the assumptions that we have about the dominant use of urban infrastructure and where we belong within the city. But thinking about the night and the people that sort of built their beds in the city streets, or the people that avoid going to bed and dance away the night, made me think about sort of the home and its position within this book as a space where it's kind of private, where maybe the infrastructures of the state don't reach as much, but which are very much structured by them at the same time. So I was thinking about, for example, the women that I met in Lima who had to set their alarm clock at 2 o'clock at night because that's when the water starts running in the pipes. So they fill their buckets to last during the day. Or like this, these self-constructed extensions of infrastructures into the home to make sure that there is electricity, that there's water, that there's sanitation, sewerage. So yeah, I was thinking, like, what is the role of the home within infrastructural time, and how does infrastructural time dictate domestic life? But I look forward to discussing it all with you.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for, firstly, if you pardon the pun, taking the time to engage the book in such, I think, rich, detailed, and generative ways. And it's very interesting to think about, and this is perhaps the timeline of the book itself, because when we write things with books or articles, they have their own kind of afterlives. And when Michael, Jen, and I were sitting down to think through what this book project was going to be, think about how we wanted to structure our arguments, we come up with a particular vantage point. But it's been really fascinating to hear your reflections about how and where you've approached the book, the types of themes which have kind of resonated with your own kind of experiences, because all knowledge about, you know, infrastructure, time, and everything else is fundamentally situated. So I think kind of getting the reflections on your different perspectives and how you come to the book has been really kind of interesting to hear. And I think it's worth perhaps taking a step back and, well, perhaps introducing myself. So I'm Jean-Paul Addy. I'm one of the editors of Infrastructural Times, and I'm based in the Urban Studies Institute at Georgia State University. And my background is as a critical geographer. The work that I do kind of centers, broadly speaking, on an understanding of the politics of infrastructure, which has traditionally been, you know, spatial, thinking about things from a geographic perspective. One of the ways in which that's materialized over the past 5 or 6 years is through work which I've been doing with Michael and Jen through a Regional Studies Association research network on infrastructural regionalisms, which has been kind of focused on thinking about bringing the region, which is a spatial construct really, into how the current global infrastructural turn has taken place. And this is an infrastructural turn, both in terms of the type of things that people are writing about in the social and policy sciences, but also the kind of the infrastructural moment that we're living in. And I think Schindler and Kanai's work around infrastructural-led development kind of redirects us to the fact that infrastructure is having a moment in the sun where it's being leveraged by states at a variety of different levels in pursuit of a number of kind of economic, territorial, and political ambitions. So we started kind of thinking about this intersection through the Noir network between infrastructure studies and regional studies. And we were getting some kind of initial conversations off the ground. And one of the things which we found striking was the ways in which time and temporality emerged in the conversations, whether it's people thinking about long-term regional strategic planning, the kind of the pace of environmental assessments, the temporality of political cycles, and how that's kind of overmeshed with the development and funding of particular infrastructural projects. And that kind of struck me as really an interesting revelation, particularly thinking about this from a geographical perspective, which is typically foreground kind of notions of space and spatiality. That's kind of the entry point, which I think kind of brought the three of us down the kind of the rabbit hole of thinking about notions of time and temporality. There's a way in which, and Timothy Mitchell said, the tendency or the standard way to think about writing about infrastructure is to start from questions of space and treat time as a consequence of that, even if this is something which kind of obscures what's most important about kind of building infrastructures. And the work that we're doing in the book, the conversations which we're trying to initiate, were looking to provide something of a temporal inversion to this way of thinking about infrastructure. And once you kind of start thinking in that realm, it's not a conversation which emerges out of nowhere. So I think it's important to recognize that the book engages with or attempts to engage with, builds a dialogue with a variety of infrastructural scholarship which has kind of centered questions of temporality. And you can see a lot of this stuff in anthropology, The Promise of Infrastructure being kind of a classic, another edited volume which kind of stresses infrastructure's temporalities. STS, as also kind of the histories of technology, kind of foreground questions of time in a way in which where the three of us, Michael, Jen, and I, were coming from, weren't necessarily at the forefront of our conversations. The book itself is, well, this is an edited volume. And if you're editing something, it's a different kind of task than if you're thinking about kind of writing a monograph yourself. There's a different kind of purpose in producing a book. The goal of, I think, of what we were trying to do in Infrastructural Times is to facilitate a conversation rather than necessarily make some definitive grand statement about what infrastructure times and temporalities are. But recognizing first the interdisciplinary conversations that questions of time can bring to the fore. As I think that, you know, we came to time recognizing the temporality of the work that we were doing without it necessarily being kind of what's at the foreground. And in curating the conversations which we sought to put together, it was really interesting to work with a variety of authors, some of them kind of established kind of leaders in the field, people who've inspired our work in a variety of different ways, also rising stars, people who have kind of a new distinct perspective to add. And some of these people kind of think about time at the forefront of the work that they're doing. Others, the book projects and the kind of workshops which underpinned the initial kind of formulation of the book were an opportunity to kind of provoke temporal thinking or say, well, hey, given the work that you're doing, what does foregrounding questions of time bring out that aren't necessarily quite at the forefront in the way that you're currently kind of thinking or writing? So it was something really generative in reaching out to the diversity of contributors that we had across the different disciplinary perspectives that they were coming from, and having a number of people sort of engage in conversations around infrastructural time, temporality, rhythm, timing, that weren't necessarily at the forefront in the ways that they had been writing originally. So in doing an edited volume, I think what we were trying to do is establish the parameters for a conversation around time, and that's kind of flavored by our particular perspectives. I'm really glad that Hannah raised the significance of politics throughout this, because that's a fundamental concern that we have with the social production of time, directing access, the ability of groups to be able to control time, manage time, to create time for themselves is not something which is equally available to everyone. And so that's a privilege to be able to operate in a way in which you can control or shape temporal rhythms or withdraw yourself from them. The political elements of that, I think, kind of seep through the chapters in a number of kind of really interesting ways, from Cotard's conversation around regimes of historiosity. We're thinking about the capacity of particular actors, the role of the state, amongst others, to shape how infrastructural systems and constellations kind of come into being. Whereas Simone kind of shifts that framing, still being interested in questions of the relationship between infrastructure, past, present, and futures, but in a way that kind of decenters and destabilizes the primacy of particular actors in the infrastructural enabling regime and fields. I think one of the things which is also kind of worth kind of flagging in relation to our objectives in the book and why infrastructure and time is so important is the idea that, again, a number of anthropologists have made this argument, is that infrastructure is they're always kind of future thinking in its orientation. It's a promise to the future made in the present, or another way of putting that would be it presents the future, both in terms of bringing it into the current kind of temporal moment, but also representing futures in a particular way through our infrastructural imaginaries. And with that, time kind of percolates a whole bunch of things. It's very difficult once you kind of start looking at it to think about and exist outside of time, temporality, and kind of the pace and rhythms through which kind of urban and infrastructural systems are put together and operated. So I think just to respond quickly to some of the questions raised in the initial round of commentaries, starting in reverse order, to Fenner's question, do new temporalities end? I think that's a kind of a really interesting question. And when is infrastructural time past? Well, how do we get at that? I think it's constructive here to perhaps address that question or think through it, recognizing notions of temporal oral temporalities, where infrastructural time may be over for some, but persists for others, whether it's in the phantom presence of unbuilt infrastructure or imaginaries, which persist even if the infrastructures themselves were never built or have kind of fallen into disrepair. To think about the notion of, you know, do temporalities have an end? It says, well, do they have it outside? That's, I think, kind of a provocative way of thinking about things. And one of the directions that it would be, it's kind of beyond where the book goes, but kind of where we ended up in the conclusion, was thinking about questions of indigenous time and indigenous temporality, because so much of our thinking about time is shaped by the modern notion of time's arrow, a logical linear progression, where Anishinaabe time or Maori time or indigenous forms of temporality don't exist in that same kind of linear temporal fashion. We have time as spirals, times which kind of collapse and fold in the past and the future into the present, which extends kind of really interesting questions about the scales of responsibility around infrastructural developments, both to our human and non-human in urban infrastructures. So whether new temporalities ends, I think, is a really kind of provocative question that we can lay on to perhaps some notions around the rights to the city. So whose time are we thinking about across what spatial scales or temporal scales? Questions of the home are also kind of fascinating if we're thinking about this kind of scalar dynamic and the home becoming a lens to refract a number of the kind of the temporal concerns which run through the book. And while you were kind of talking, I was thinking about Nikhil Anand's Hydraulic City, where he spends quite a lot of time thinking about that water time and the work of social reproduction, how that is kind of established by the rhythms of access to water, which is turned on and off various times in and around Mumbai. The question of home brings us, I think, to that notion of scale and perhaps some of Himanshu's questions around the tensions between the urban and the infrastructural, where the book is primarily but not exclusively urban. And we can think about its urbanity as a scale, as an analytic, and as a level of social reality, which I like to do kind of leaning on some Lefebvrean ways of thinking about that. But as a framing, like the urban illuminates particular questions as it puts others to the side. And in our conversations, Michael Jen and I would be, you know, thinking about what are the distinctions between urban and regional perspectives? Because if we shift to the regional, different sets of actors, different political constellations come to the fore, different temporal horizons emerge. And each of those actors, each of those infrastructures exists and operates over different timeframes and different horizons. So the question of who can see over what spatial scales is also kind of applicable to who can see over what futures. And Michael and I have been doing work with regional planning organizations in the US, where perhaps the transportation improvement plans that metropolitan planning organizations have to work through are scaled to like a five-year imaginary. So we're compressing the future which we can imagine through this particular planning instrument, whereas strategic planning unfolds over a lot longer process, whether it's 20 or 30 years, but not everyone is privileged enough to be able to kind of select the futures over which they're envisioning infrastructural development taking place. So the home's going to provide a different kind of scalar lens to perhaps engage with some of those questions. Anna's questions around, could we get some more direction towards equitable futures? And this is a really important question. And it's one that the book probably will hopefully serve as a springboard for if it doesn't necessarily kind of engage with this as much as it might. I think there are some avenues to mobilize how a variety of the authors in the book can help us kind of move towards this end, even if the book doesn't necessarily kind of foreground that as directly as it may have. So how can we think about opening more equitable infrastructural futures? I think one of the useful elements of the book will hopefully be a way to open the voices which are consulted or available to engage that conversation with. I think Abdi Malik Simone's writing sort of, it's always fascinating to kind of dive into his particular approach to the urban and the infrastructural. But when he's writing about Jayapura and he's thinking about questions of extensions, communities who are existing, perhaps on the peripheries of broader kind of state mandates of infrastructural development, there's a variety of actors who are perhaps not consulted in the future of the city of Jayapura, the future of Indonesia, but are fundamentally kind of embedded in the production of a variety of different infrastructural times. And I was always struck by a quote from one of his articles where he's thinking about the city doesn't need to kind of be what it is, have a particular structure of infrastructural arrangements or state architectures, because the ways in which people kind of inhabit space mean that there are a variety of different ways that the city can become what it needs to be anyway, or do what it does anyway. And I think there's a temporal component that is particularly important to understand how the city is kind of produced by people unintentionally without a plan or without ascribing to some form of infrastructural kind of meta-narrative of a variety of levels. So one, perhaps, is a way in which we can think about opportunities to open the voices who are engaged in conversations around equitable infrastructural futures. I think embracing different temporalities could also be a constructive way in which the book can help inform this conversation. again, thinking about where the conclusion ends up and the potentiality of perhaps engaging with some indigenous temporalities to disrupt or rethink modern senses of progress and time and the work that infrastructure is doing in ways that can be perhaps slower, perhaps more ethical. And finally, I think that you flagged by Olivier Courtard's chapter on infrastructure-based futuring, which ends up with a variety of conversations about how we might kind of mobilize notions of infrastructural futuring, whether it's through speculative games or thinking about a sort of Eric Olin Wright's envisioning real utopias kind of approach. And like Tim Moss's chapter, I think, is also kind of really methodologically interesting as a way to not just understand how infrastructural past are created, but what's their value and how can we pick up and represent, reinterpret, reuse the physical and the imagined infrastructures of the past to shape the future in hopefully more inclusive, equitable, or sustainable ways. I think that's where I'll leave my initial kind of rounds of responses. But again, thank you very much for your engagement and reflections on the book.
Yeah, I really appreciated how, in a way, many of the chapters opened up many more questions, that there wasn't sort of a prescriptive proposal for how we need to think about infrastructural time and the intersections of time and infrastructure, but it was really evocative and generative in that it opened up all these different possible directions and gives readers tools as well to kind of continue on thinking about that. Maybe just to go back to that question of scale or trying to phrase it as a question of home and the kind of the absence of the home in the book. Because I'm also interested in infrastructures as a link between this kind of capital P politics, state, big state project, and the lowercase p politics, so how the state makes itself, you know, like felt in everyday life, shapes subjectivities, how those experiences make people then turn to different politics to pursue. I thought it was interesting how the different parts of the book took sort of different perspectives and how that moved across the different sections. So in parts one and two, the chapters almost kind of replicate that kind of God's eye view of infrastructural systems as rather sort of abstract entities, replicating that kind of top-down discourse of states, of planners, developers, you know, finance institutions, and so on. And then in part three, you segue into these ethnographies of the lived reality of tinkering on small scales, kind of more embodied, subjective, and affective experiences. Yeah, and I see that as a challenge maybe to all of us as infrastructure scholars, and how to link those big infrastructural visions and discussions with the impact on the ground, or how to test that promise of infrastructure against the lived reality that often doesn't live up to that promise. And as you mentioned, Tim Moss's chapter on unusable pasts was really useful there, because it offers these conceptual tools at the same time that it's really grounded in that material history. But I also had my own really subjective response to it as someone who grew up in East Berlin in the 1980s and 90s. And I thought, it's not really a very academic point, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. He talks about these water pumps, and it made me kind of think of growing up, using these pumps that were, you know, quite antiquated at the time, but also, you know, coal heated ovens, toilets that were, you know, outside of the home, horse-drawn carriages, really growing up, you know, not that long ago in a Berlin that is not that different from the Berlin that Walter Benjamin described in, like, growing up in around the 1900s. And so that made me think about infrastructure in a kind of sense of collective memory and collective identity, because of course other modern infrastructures existed in parallel at that time, but these kind of overlaps and this continuity and redundancy that Moss talks about, also feeds into that kind of continuity, and especially in a place that's so marked by historical ruptures like Berlin was.
It's funny that you mentioned Moss, Anna, and especially his image of the pump that continues to work, right? And in a sense, this layering, you know, the operational layering, or, you know, the extant layers of different histories of infrastructure in cities, which he invokes, also lead me to think of, you know, the, in a sense, the disavowal in Indian cities of older traditions and older operational infrastructures of water management, which can only be explained, well, at least partly be explained by a kind of coloniality of infrastructural type, which works in many different ways. There is a kind of, you could say that in, you know, there is a city in called Aurangabad, which has maybe a 400-600-year-old water supply system, which still serves a part of the city. But after being neglected and damaged, in fact, ravaged, just, you know, stone being taken away from the constructions, aqueducts, etc. On the one hand, that. On the other, the enormous crisis that we face, we are facing, staring into the very near future of groundwater. And equally, an entire infrastructural establishment, which is completely unable to see anything but already outdated engineering solutions and imaginaries to do with water supply. And this, across different sectors, different kinds of infrastructure sectors, for us, for a lot of us in India, it seems to really suggest a strong continuity of coloniality across into post-colonial time. So even after decolonization, what we are actually living through right at this very moment in the particular choices that are made in, say, transport infrastructure, we are trapped in a certain, you know, especially I think the post-colonial elites, interestingly, the best educated of among us in many ways, are still trapped in colonial modes of valuing our own pasts, valuing even what is known as to be scientific knowledge today, and being in the thrall of ready-made solutions and even solutionism, which, interestingly, this past is blocking our abilities to really keep the future open and think in ways which acknowledge the present for what it is, and from here lead on to the future. So on the one hand, an inability to even engage the past because a colonial value system has made it impossible for Indian elite to recognize any value in our own past. And on the other, a scientific education, a kind of modernity of sorts, makes it very difficult for you to fully engage what we know about the present and the future that's coming up very fast. So I think for me, the coloniality of infrastructure time is something which is has many different works in many different directions.
Yeah, I think the coloniality of infrastructural time, I think, is a really interesting kind of problematic to think about. And the Barbara Adam, sociologist of time, kind of makes a nice distinction between colonization of time. We think about the creeping imposition of temporal regimes and registers on a variety of social formations, and colonization with time, so using time and temporality as a means to exert control or domination over particular groups, to set the order, to set the rhythms through which urban life, everyday life, is kind of conditioned. And I think while you were talking about this, I was struck by, on one hand, these notions of the persistence of outdated solutions, where infrastructure sets up certain kind of path dependencies in both material, discursive ways. But it also got me thinking about Hannah's work around infrastructural violence and how coloniality, or the imposition of particular temporal registers, or the roles of particular infrastructure in facilitating violence over time takes a number of different temporal logics. So we can have immediate forms of infrastructural violence, that kind of explosive, visceral moments. But we also have the modalities of slow violence, and we can think about that in the coloniality of India. John Stalin just visited Georgia State University last week, and he was talking about the political economy of highway removal, which, again, in the context of the US, we can see, you know, clearly the racialized use of highway infrastructure to enforce particular social, economic, racial landscapes in American cities. I think kind of why I bring that back, and I'm interested in all of your kind of thoughts on this, is if we're thinking about infrastructural time as a way in which particular forms of violence are enacted, does that have ramifications for how we might think about what temporal justice looks like? So if we have slow violence kind of rolled out over decades, over centuries, what are the capacities of infrastructural systems to enable us to realize some form of reparative or restorative justice? And what are the temporal logics which might underpin that type of process?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I have an entire answer to this because that's a gigantic question. But we have been trying to, in this case is me and Ayona Datta, who am I collaborating with at the moment. So we've been trying to think about not only the temporal politics within infrastructure, but also power and how time is used as a way to exert power. And I think that kind of helps us then think, or maybe it'll help us think a little bit more about also justice and more just urban futures. So the way that we've been trying to conceptualize this is drawing on Deleuzean understandings of time. And I'm getting a little bit nervous of trying to explain Deleuze because I'm definitely not a scholar of Deleuze entirely. But in our understanding of it and how we've been trying to use it, to understand time, his distinction in Cinema 1 and Cinema 2 about the time image and the movement image. Basically, how we've been operationalizing it, drawing on other people's work such as Crockett, is that there's a distinction between time as movement, in which it can be measured and understood and experienced through speed, suspension, waiting. And there is time as order, in which it creates hierarchies and structures and also time certain action. And this is, I think, kind of that time as order is where we can also see the power created, right? Where certain times and temporalities are created as more important, whereas others are sort of rendered subaltern. Himanshu gives a very clear example of that in talking about the coloniality of time and how within education, like we also sort of internalize that dominant time of sort of modern time. Through time as order, we can also think about reordering things or restructuring things. And maybe that's where we can sort of exert power in trying to bring other times to the forefront or other understandings of time that are not as linear as modernist conceptions of time, but that engage more with these indigenous conceptions of time that you were speaking about earlier, Jean-Paul.
Thanks. That was very interesting. But I was also wondering, Jean-Paul, whether a slow justice, a slow enduring move towards justice could be approached by shifting out of the orbit of time, in a sense, or thinking of time as the domain of intervention and into the domain of structure. And so maybe pursuing structural justice as a goal through various means which are not necessarily strictly temporal or an intervention in the temporal might be a way of ensuring a long and I think sustained move towards a more enduringly just world.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I think that one of the questions which I have in kind of response to that is that how might we think about kind of removing ourselves from the temporal orders which we all inhabit out of necessity, whether they're the kind of our personal individual ones or ones which are shaped by states or by capitalism or by whatever other like structures we might think about. I think in this context, you know, imagine when you were talking about the notions of presentism and futurism, I think one of the challenges that we have perhaps one of the opportunities that we have by thinking about temporality in this is to try and push against some of the walls of presentism which bound the types of thinking that are possible in relation to infrastructural forms of injustice, where immediate timelines of resolutions or kind of short-term interventions, whether that's because of what's kind of politically possible or because that's the parameters of our infrastructural interventions, inhibit our ability to do something which is more transformative and more radical. And kind of going back to the book, I think this is one of the arguments which Olivier Courtade makes when he's thinking about these regimes of historiosity, where our current moment is so constrained by presentism, whether this is thinking about smart city technologies and the kind of ideas of Rock Kitchen, that we can't kind of break out of the current moment. and perhaps the resolution to things like highway infrastructure require more than immediate fixes to do we take down highways? How do we kind of reallocate highway capacity? There's a need to kind of perhaps push out and beyond, but still thinking temporally, but push beyond a modern kind of futurist mindsets to perhaps kind of foreground how those notions of structural change, our understanding of transformative capacities of infrastructure might be realized in ways which move beyond some of the intellectual and material path dependencies our current infrastructural moment provides for us.
Let me just add one last thing. I think it struck me to, I agree, Jean-Paul, there is something to be said perhaps about how to, you know, engage the temporal in thinking of this future. And it struck me that perhaps one way is to replace presentism with presentness, a greater engagement with the fullness of the present, including the past and also what we know from the present and the past about where we are headed into the future, which is something that actually in some senses is very simple, and it's for some reasons I think very well developed in the book, especially in the political economy story of it. And that's perhaps one place, one site where the politics of infrastructure and infrastructural time plays out very, very interesting.
So, Fanny, we're going back to the idea about who has the capacity to see the future. The ability to see the future through infrastructure is something which is, I think, on one hand, a privilege. And while perhaps there's a normative way of thinking about that capacity as something which is held by particular elites, it's the privilege to be able to do it. For those people who don't have that, you know, futurist orientation of the space in which to have that kind of futurist mindset, perhaps there's a lot of value to kind of recognizing the embeddedness in the present and the kind of the immediacy to it. And I think kind of thinking about Malik Simone's chapter, then that kind of gives us a way to kind of understand how people are captured in that present moment. If they're denied a future and they're denied a past, that doesn't mean that they're powerless in the present. It means that there's a particular set of situated knowledges, a particular set of temporal practices and relations to time that we might be able to tap into in generative ways. But if I want to take the prerogative of having the closing word on this, I think one of the outcomes of the process of putting the book together, and I think kind of the nature of the conversation that we've had today, is that there's still a lot of work to be done in this space. And once you kind of open the can of worms of thinking about time and temporality, it is something which becomes pretty pervasive in the ways in which, at least for me, how we're going to think about urban and infrastructural systems, how we think about regionality, and then kind of folding into that, you know, the questions of home, violence, coloniality, and all these other dimensions which we've discussed today. So I think if the book kind of accomplishes something in helping to establish a framework for those conversations or pushing that dialogue forward, I think Michael, Jen, and I will be very happy about what the book's doing out in the world.
Thanks a lot for your time, and thanks for this really generative conversation. So maybe we close there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for organizing the conversation. I think that was really interesting. And again, thanks to all of you for kind of participating and poking the book in interesting directions, which I hadn't necessarily thought about through the act of writing it or putting it together.
Thanks for putting it together. So
yeah, it's such an interesting book. It's been really lovely to read. Yeah. Thanks for this opportunity to discuss it with you guys.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.